Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Joe, for that reading of the fifth chapter of the book of Daniel. I don't know that I ever heard you read before, but God has blessed you with talent in that area. Just a little disclosure here. Bill emailed me this week and asked what the reading should be, and I said the fifth chapter of Daniel, but then when I saw you coming up a while ago, I thought, oh, maybe I should have just had him read a portion of it, but man, you could have read the whole book. You do yeoman work for us. Appreciate that deeply. I would like to just comment on this chapter that he has read. It's a substantial chapter and stands on its own without comment, but I'll just say a few things about it as our lesson this morning. You may have noticed, first of all, that in the book of Daniel, every chapter except the last one begins with a sentence including the name of the ruling monarch and sometimes even adds the year of his reign. Every chapter except chapter 12. So as we look at chapter 5, we should say a little word about the Babylonian kings because Nebuchadnezzar's gone. In our class this morning, we looked at chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar was the king. We said he was the most significant king of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, and he reigned through most of it himself. But here we have a different king. I have always called him Belshazzar, but I like Belshazzar, as Joe put it. That's probably more correct, because I tend to anglicize everything. And I'm going to try to call him Belshazzar as we talk about him, just because I think it probably is indeed more correct. With these kings, we don't know as much as we would like because our sources are fragmentary, the evidence that we use to determine them. But we do know that Nabopolassar was the first king of the Babylonian Empire. He's the one that gained independence and established the kingdom. And then Nebuchadnezzar the second, as we call him, was the next one. There was another Nebuchadnezzar clear back about 1100 B.C. in the original Babylonian Empire, but that has nothing to do with the book of Daniel. So the man we call Nebuchadnezzar is really Nebuchadnezzar II, just in the larger context of history. So he was second, and then there were several after that who are rather inconsequential. One of them I've always called Nerigliser, but I think I'm going to call him Neriglissar because that's probably a little more accurate. Several kings there we don't need to concern ourselves with too much, although a son of Nebuchadnezzar by the name of Evil-Merodach ruled. We find him written about in 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 27, and also in Jeremiah 52, verse 31, a son of Nebuchadnezzar that was assassinated by Nerigliosar. But we come on down to 556 B.C., and we have Nabonidus. Nabonidus is a son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. The throne was actually usurped on his behalf. He was already aging at the time that he became the king, and he was the father of Belshazzar, who shared the throne with him during the last part of his reign. Nabonidus actually reigned for 17 years, but for 14 of those years, he never set foot in Babylon. He was other places. Some people called him the archaeologist king because he was interested in that. Some people think he went crazy. That ran in the family to a certain degree, it seems. We don't know too much about Nabonidus, but we do know that his son Belshazzar was his regent and was the acting king, so that it's perfectly proper to call Belshazzar the king, as the text does in verse 1, which Joe read. So it's been a while since Nebuchadnezzar, but Belshazzar is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. We have the statement made in the 18th chapter of the book of Ezekiel that the soul that sinneth, it shall die. And we find that civilizations follow the same patterns as individuals. The city of Babylon was second to none in its heyday. In fact, it's almost unbelievable what it was like. It was a 15-mile square, if you can imagine that. That's enormous for an ancient city. A 15-mile square, 60-mile perimeter around this city with a wall that was 350 feet high, if you can believe that. 350 feet high and 87 feet thick. Four golden chariots marched abreast around the top of the wall, pulled by black stallions because they were constantly on guard. There was a 30-foot moat outside the wall of the city of Babylon. It was considered an impregnable city. The population of the city of Babylon was 1,200,000 people, just tremendously huge for that time. There was a constant water supply because the Euphrates River flowed right through the city of Babylon under the city walls. At the time the city was besieged, it also had 20 years of supplies on the inside of it. You could see why these people would tend to be a little smug, because they thought nobody could overtake them. Nabonidus, as we've said, was not a homebody. He traveled. He was other places. He was engaged in diplomacy of various kinds. So it was left to Belshazzar to stay at home. And it seems that Belshazzar, or Belshazzar, was an insecure, wild, loose-living man who covered his insecurity with heavy drink. As this chapter begins, the Medes and the Persians have already been laying strategy for conquering Babylon. The city is under siege, and the Babylonians know that, but they're smug. They're complacent. They're living it up, thinking that they can't be conquered. So in verses 2 through 4, and I'm not going to reread it because Joe did so and did such a good job, Belshazzar's about 36 years old at this time. He's old enough to know better, but not old enough to have had a great deal of experience yet. He calls a banquet to exalt their gods and, in essence, to mock Jehovah. Let's bring those golden vessels out that my grandpa took out of the city of Jerusalem when he conquered it years ago, back when the young men were brought here that were trained to be the servants of the king. That was in 605 B.C. That was the first captivity that Nebuchadnezzar did with the city of Jerusalem. And it's been a while now, but these golden vessels have just been sitting there in the house of one of the false gods. One writer imagined this banquet this way. Shortly, the slave arrived with the holy vessels at that raucous banquet room. The moment had arrived for this maggot of a man, Belshazzar, to do a God-defying act. The erotic dancing suddenly stopped. The musicians put down their instruments and the house lights were turned up. Obviously, that would mean they just made the flames a little brighter. They took away the shields that were over some of these flames so that you could see better. Belshazzar took the goblet, filled it from his own private wine, and smirking with arrogance, slopped the crimson liquid to his lips. As it dribbled down his beard, he glared around with that, "Hey, I've done it," look, as if possessed by the devil he was honoring. "He has done it," a thousand guests gasped. And suddenly a cheer broke out, blasphemously applauding the daring act. Belshazzar sunk down in his elegant seat, the music and dancing beginning again. Ah, at last, he felt like a man. At that point, there was an interruption in the banquet designed to change all the feasting and merriment. In verse 5, the year and the day is October the 12th, 539 B.C., This is the time of the handwriting on the wall. Just try to picture it if you can. Perhaps scratching out with a fingernail the message on the wall, maybe in an area that had been blackened by the flame of a torch, or maybe this message was actually scratched into the plaster itself. And suddenly Belshazzar is sober. This might be the record for going from drunk to sober. I have had highway patrolmen tell me that even if a person is drunk, they can do a reasonable job, if they're not too drunk, of pretending to be sober when you stop them. Difference between alcohol and amphetamines, perhaps. Amphetamines is not as controllable, but alcohol, to a certain extent, seems to be. That's why they have the breathalyzer. That's why they have you walk a line and do other things that drunk people can't do. By the way, in an excavating, we did find a room with plaster walls that also had a niche for the king to sit in. Could have been the very room that we're talking about here. The night has come when the cup of God's wrath is full. Clear back in the days before the flood, Noah was told, "My spirit shall not always strive with man." The reason God does these events at various times is recorded in the third chapter of the Roman letter, that every mouth may be stopped and that all the world may become guilty before God. Proud, loud mouths get slammed shut. And in verse 6, there's a description of the terror that Belshazzar experiences. His knees are knocking. His hip joints are like they're out of joint. He's just shaking all over. So he makes this promise that whoever can solve this riddle, I will give him third position in the kingdom. Why third? Because it's after my dad and me, Belshazzar would say. My dad is the real king. I am the acting king, and you'll be third in the kingdom. So he calls in this group of people, the astrologers and all the rest, people that have already proven twice in the book of Daniel that they as a group cannot interpret messages from Jehovah. We saw it in verse 2 and we saw it in chapter 4. But we're creatures of habit, and so when Belshazzar is in a jam, he calls these same people in, and obviously they're not able to interpret the handwriting on the wall. So the queen mother or the queen regnant steps in at this point. She's known to history as Nitocris, but the Bible does not call her that. Anyway, Nitocris seems to have been the wife of Nabonidus and the mother of Belshazzar. She may also have had some relationship to Nebuchadnezzar herself, in addition to her husband being related to him. Anyway, Nitocris comes in and she educates her son Belshazzar in verse 11. There is a man in your kingdom who can tell you what those words on the wall mean. And she expresses that Daniel has quite a reputation by now, even though Belshazzar seems oblivious to it. And in verse 13, Daniel is called in. Daniel walks in an old man. He's in his 80s now. We first meet him back in chapter 1, and he's probably a young teenager, maybe from 12 to 14 years of age when first taken away in 605 B.C., but now he has run the full gamut almost of the Babylonian Empire, and he's in his 80s. He's full of all kinds of experiences. Walter Cronkite anchored the CBS Evening News through 8 presidents of the United States. Daniel now has served through 7 kings of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And he's going to serve through a couple more kings of another empire before he dies. So Nitocris says there's a man with the reputation for doing the impossible. He speaks for God. Better call him in. You know, Daniel was never tainted by his time. I think the most outstanding element of his character was his moral courage. Bear in mind that in Babylon there was no temple worship for the Jews. There was no Sabbath worship as a part of the culture, as there had been back home when Daniel was a boy. There was possibly not even a complete copy of the Hebrew writings that had accumulated up to that time. Though it seems that Daniel did have the book of Jeremiah, because in chapter 9 we find him reading it. And if the legend is true about him showing King Cyrus part of the book of Isaiah, then maybe he had the book of Isaiah as well. But I don't know of any evidence that he had all the writings, although he may have had. The point is that with few aids to devotion for 70 years, Daniel remained utterly true to God under the most unfavorable circumstances. Daniel is one of the few Bible characters about whom nothing negative is reported. Now, we know that Daniel must have sinned because all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. But no sin is reported of Daniel. Everything about him is just right in everything that's said regarding him. And we should never underestimate the power of one godly life lived before the church and lived before the world. It has an impact that might not at first be apparent, but over time, it says a lot to people. So in verse 13, picture being in the presence of a drunken king who is suddenly sober and who is totally panic-stricken for information. And he's promising you all these unbelievable riches. He's bargaining with you to do something that will bring him relief. Think of the politics of that moment. Daniel could have asked for anything and gotten it. Was Daniel tempted? I think probably not at this age. Sometimes a young man will play to the grandstand. Sometimes a young man thinking that he has a long future on earth might do that type of thing. But Daniel is no longer young, and there are great advantages to that. You may remember the story of Barzillai the Gileadite in King David's day, hundreds of years before this time. Barzillai did David a great service, and David wanted to reward him. So he said, come and live with me in the palace, Barzillai. And Barzillai says, hey, I'm 80 years old. What is the finery of your palace going to mean to me? I can't even hear the singers that you've got there. And he goes on talking about that. All I want to do is live where I live and die and be buried with my family. So there comes a time when the treasures of this earth don't mean so much anymore. And Daniel is at that point. Verse 16, Belshazzar says, here's my bargain. And Daniel isn't having it. Verse 17, Daniel doesn't even say, long live the king. That was the thing you would ordinarily say to a king. He doesn't say, long live the king, because he knows that king's not going to live very long. Keep your gifts for yourself. Give your rewards to somebody else. In essence, why be third ruler in a kingdom that's only got a few hours to last anyway? I'll just pause here and say that any place there are men and women of God, there will come temptations to prostitute your calling. There will be wealthy or influential people who will make you promises if you will do or say as they wish. In fact, the larger the influence, the greater will be the pressure to fit into their scheme of things. They are hoping to manipulate you by some means. You have to determine who you're going to serve. Are you going to serve God, or are you going to be intimidated by people? The Apostle Paul faced this very thing. Galatians 1:10, he describes it. Do I seek to please men? If I were still trying to please men, indicating that there had been a time in his life when he was younger that he did, if I were still trying to please men, I would not be the servant of Christ, he says. You have to pick one or the other. So Daniel says, keep your gifts. I don't need those trappings. And there's no feeling so free as the freedom from intimidation. Verse 17 gives a good guideline for those of us who teach the Word of God. Daniel says there that I'm just going to read the writing that's on the wall, and then I will make known the interpretation to you. That is simple, and that's the way to do it. Read it and make the interpretation known. We can't do any better than that. Just expositorily teaching the Word of God. Verses 18 through 21, Daniel reviews the Babylonian history that I think you and I are already pretty familiar with. But Daniel's doing this as an eyewitness. He's been around now for virtually 70 years. And in case Belshazzar wants to plead ignorance to this history and say, oh, I didn't know all that, Daniel says, Belshazzar, you did know. You knew all this. You may have ignored it, but you knew all this. Belshazzar lived as though he was the master of his own fate apart from God. He knew all this, according to Daniel, who was in a position to know what Belshazzar knew. But there's nothing that great about knowing something. You may know a lot of Bible about the judgment of God, but that alone does you no good at all. Belshazzar did not change. This is the issue. Belshazzar didn't change. There are people who have heard truths from God's book all their life, but it has not yet captured their heart. And that's what is said in verse 22. Belshazzar, you did not humble your heart. So at this point, I want us, if we can, to put ourselves in Daniel's sandals. Daniel knew that his life could be very easily ended by this unstable pagan king. But Daniel told him the truth anyway. It's possible that somebody here right now may be at a crossroads in their life where you have to make a decision. And you know, if you make that decision for right, it's going to hurt. I urge you to stand for what is right anyway and let the chips fall where they will. Let's get to the writing. And Joe did a great job of pronouncing it. He's probably more correct than what I'm going to say, but I only know one way to say it. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Remember, this is in the Aramaic language from Daniel 2:4 down through the end of chapter 7. It's all written in Aramaic. And the literal translation here, the stripped away literal translation, just means numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. Some people think that the seconding of the numbered might mean ended. Numbered, ended, weighed, divided. Originally, keep in mind, there were no vowels in this and probably no breaks either. So it would not be something that would be easily decipherable for us in our time. But the rubber meets the road in verses 26 through 28 where we have the interpretation. And Joe just read it for us. You are weighed in the balances and found wanting. God has got your number, and God has numbered you. The general of Cyrus's army was already at the gates of Babylonia at that very moment. The troops had diverted the waters of the Euphrates River about 100 miles north of Babylon, drained that most of that water off into a swamp, and now the troops of Cyrus and the Persian Empire were marching up the bed of the river into the city of Babylon, which lay on both its banks. The river gates had been left unguarded because they didn't think they needed a guard, and Babylon, supposedly secure behind massive walls, was now as good as conquered. It was taken over that night without a shot being fired, not only because they didn't have gunpowder yet, but also because it was a sneak attack. A very clever, ingenious strategy, yes. But remember, no matter how Cyrus did this and no matter how clever it was, God had already declared not only that the city of Babylon would fall, but when the city of Babylon would fall. I want to take the time to read just a couple of verses out of Jeremiah 27, which was written sometime before this. Now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. This is Jeremiah 27, verse 6. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beast of the field have I given him also to serve him. And all nations shall serve him, that's Nebuchadnezzar, and his son, Evil-Merodach, and his son's son, Belshazzar, until the very time of his land come. And then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him. In other words, he's going to be like a feast, and they're going to eat his feast. And it shall come to pass that the nation and kingdom which shall not serve the same Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and that will not be put their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation will I punish, saith the Lord, with the sword and with the famine and with the pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand. It reminds me of what Paul said on Mars Hill, that God determines the times before appointed and the bounds of the habitations of nations. God has something to do with determining how much land a nation has and how long that nation lasts. He brings this about through providential means, and that's what he's doing in Daniel chapter 5. God had declared that Nebuchadnezzar and his son and his son's sons would rule, and then that empire would collapse. It's all been determined by God. The details are worked out through the providence of God. The Persians used this city after they conquered it. You know, Isaiah 13 is another pertinent passage here. Maybe I can take the time just to read a bit of Isaiah 13, although the whole chapter is pertinent to the fall of Babylon. But I'll just read a little bit. Verse 19, Isaiah 13:19. Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation, neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. So this was going to be the end of it. 175 years before the events of Daniel 5. And if I had read more there, he talks about the very people that were in the banquet hall that night and how they're going to be overcome. I will stir up the Medes against them, he says in verses 17 through 22. And he even says it shall never be inhabited. You know, Will Durant, the historian, studied to be a Roman Catholic priest before becoming an agnostic unbeliever, but he wrote the 11-volume Story of Civilization, and I remember reading many, many years ago, volume one of that Story of Civilization. When I got to page 218, I read about Babylon, and he said, it's hard to believe as I look at these hot and dusty wastes, and this was 1934 when he was looking at that, hard to believe as I look at these hot and dusty wastes, this barren wasteland, that there was ever a city here. And yet, the city of Babylon was, in its heyday, almost a miraculous city of that time. When Will Durant, in 1934, looked at the ruins of Babylon, he called it a barren wasteland, totally uninhabited, when he put out his book the next year in 1935. Alexander the Great, the Persian Empire kept the city of Babylon and used it. Alexander the Great came there as the head of the Macedonian or Grecian Empire. He wanted to turn Babylon into another Alexandria. He already had 16 Alexandrias on earth already. He wanted to make Babylon the 17th Alexandria, but it came to naught because Alexander died there at the city of Babylon. People have tried to revive Babylon. Saddam Hussein did it in our time, back in the 1980s. And it came to naught with Saddam Hussein hung for his crimes. And the last I knew of Saddam Hussein's palace, the United States Marines were camped out with their tents and mosquito netting in the living room of Saddam Hussein's palace about 2006. They had their mosquito netting there because it's right beside the Euphrates River and there were a lot of mosquitoes. So even though they were indoors, the windows were broken out and they needed their mosquito netting. But that was the end of Saddam Hussein. Nobody who has attempted to build up Babylon again and make it great has been able to succeed. Belshazzar went ahead in verse 29 and put a robe and a chain on Daniel. And you can kind of see Daniel standing there putting up with it, but I really don't need this stuff. It's like David when Saul put his armor on him. What good is a promotion when the company is bankrupt? Take this stuff away. Belshazzar, you need to realize that we're finished as an empire. Believe it. It's over. So in verses 30 and 31, this is the period to the chapter. God's judgment may seem slow, but God's judgment is thorough. In verse 5, we were told in the same hour, and in verse 30, we're told in that night. This all came crashing down all at once. When God's alarm clock goes off, it really rings. You've waited and waited, but when it comes, then it's through. Will Durant said, hot and dreary waste. It all, after Alexander, this city just wasted away until Will Durant said, hard to believe it was ever here. Remember Longfellow's poem about retribution? Though the mills of God grind slowly, yet they grind exceeding small. Though with patience he stands waiting, with exactness grinds he all. It takes a while for it to get there, but it is exact. So never underestimate the power of one godly life. When things are at their worst, God usually uses one person or a small remnant to purge the times. And you could be that person in your particular sphere of influence. If God could do it with Daniel, he can do it with you. At the feast of Belshazzar and 1,000 of his lords, while they drank from golden vessels, as the book of truth records, in the night as they reveled in the royal palace hall, they were seized with consternation at the hand upon the wall. See the brave captive Daniel as he stood before the throng and rebuked the haughty monarch for his mighty deeds of wrong. As he read out the writing, 'twas the doom of one and all, for the kingdom was now finished, said the hand upon the wall. See the zeal and faith and courage that would dare to do the right, which the Spirit gave to Daniel, this the secret of his might. Stolen from his home, Judea, captive in a pagan hall, he still understood the writing of his God upon the wall. So our deeds are recorded. There's a hand that's writing now. Sinner, give your heart to Jesus, to his royal mandate bow. For the day is fast approaching. It must come to one and all when a sinner's condemnation will be written on the wall. Nations rise and nations fall. But this has little to do with the ongoing people of God. We just keep rolling on through it all through the grace of our Lord Jesus. Our citizenship is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. Here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. Our citizenship, yes, is also in an earthly nation, but that is a secondary citizenship, and it is a distant second. Babylon the Great is fallen. Nebuchadnezzar tried to make it last. He put his name on every brick in those buildings, estimated 60 million bricks in the city of Babylon, those wonderful buildings. And every one of those bricks was stamped with the name of Nebuchadnezzar. But you know what? There's a brick in the British Museum. Because they took these bricks out when they were made of clay, of course. And after they got stamped the way they wanted them stamped, they had to lay them out in the sun to dry. They were damp clay when they laid them out in the sun to dry. There's a brick in the British Museum with a dog's footprint over the image and name of Nebuchadnezzar. And that is so illustrative of reality. Nebuchadnezzar was a haughty man that put his stamp on every brick, and somebody's dog came along and just stepped right on it. It reminds me of Gray's elegy written in a country churchyard. The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, awaits alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. So Babylon is fallen, but Daniel is still here. You know, Daniel reminds me of the minister Talleyrand during the time of the French Revolution, when there were so many upheavals, but time after time, Talleyrand is still there for the next upheaval. Surrounding the French Revolution, he kept surviving. The difference between Daniel and Talleyrand is that Daniel is a much better character than Talleyrand. You meet him again under the Medes and Persians, and he keeps on going, and his death we do not have recorded. But he remains a wonderful example for us. So I'll conclude by citing that little children's song. Dare to be a Daniel. Dare to stand alone. Dare to have a purpose firm. And dare to make it known. If we can assist you with the Lord's invitation in any way, either primary obedience or something else this morning, please know that you are more than invited as we stand together. Paul's going to lead us in an invitation number.